This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Let's get it going right here, right now. This is Diamond Conversations, and you're listening to episode 3 of Diamond Conversations on the Place to Be Podcast Network. If you didn't know by now, my name is Chad, and every single week you're going to get a specialized baseball interview on Diamond Conversations featuring somebody having to do with America's pastime, the wonderful sport of baseball, which just came to a close as the Washington Nationals have become the World Series champions for the 2019 baseball season. But we are taking a time machine back to the glorious year of 1985 today, as I'm joined by author Chris Donnelly talking about his book, Doc, Donnie, the Kid, and Billy Brawl, how the 1985 Mets and Yankees fought for New York's baseball soul. And this is a conversation I absolutely loved to have on the airwaves, especially in the early run here of Diamond Conversations, as we get to talk about New York baseball at its finest. In the heyday, as I like to say, just as I was starting to know what baseball was, the 1986 Mets being the pinnacle of the sports world for me, 1985 was the table setter for that magical 1986 Mets season. But in this interview with Chris Donnelly, we talk about everything having to do with both teams, factors that played into their success, some of the things that may have been a detriment in the long run, but just covered every aspect we could about the 1985 Major League Baseball season from the New York perspective, which had so much going on and it's so many storylines. A budding team in the New York Mets in on one side of the city, and on the other side in the Bronx, some tumultuous times with Billy Martin and George Steinbrenner and a lot of the craziness that would go on during that era of Yankee baseball on the other side of town. So Chris Donnelly wrote this book, which I had the opportunity to read an amazing Google preview of, and fell in love with the book. And as I was getting the show together here, just wanted to make it a point to get a hold of Mr. Donnelly and get the chance to talk about this book and talk about the 1985 season, because it really is one of my favorite New York Mets seasons as a whole. Obviously, the emergence of Gary Carter as the star of the New York Mets, the opening day home run, which if you've seen a Mets game in the last 30 years, they play it all the time, especially on opening day, and the significance that carried with it throughout Carter's tenure with the Mets. And obviously, funny enough, the Mets have such a magical opening day history as a whole, so that just played into it. But also love learning more about the 1985 Yankees, just an awesome team with powerhouses like Donnie Baseball, Don Mattingly, his MVP season, the emergence of Ricky Henderson with the Yankees, Dave Winfield, and so many other key parts of a team that I don't think many people realize were as good as they were, and they actually were a damn good team in 1986 as well. But we will get into that in this interview, and also hopefully down the road bring Chris Donnelly back to talk about another book that he's got, focusing on the 1995 ALDS between the Seattle Mariners and the New York Yankees, which obviously would not go the Yankees' way, but was an amazing series. And looking forward to talking about Chris Donnelly's book about that topic, maybe in the near future. Hopefully we see him coming back on Diamond Conversations real soon. So I want to thank him very much for coming on with me to talk about Doc, Donnie, the Kid, and Billy Brawl, how the 1985 Mets and Yankees fought for New York's baseball soul, which is available courtesy of the University of Nebraska Press. You can get it on Amazon, but we'll also talk about all the plugs for the books that Chris Donnelly has later on here in the interview. So we want to wrap it up here nice. But before we do, remember you can head on over to Facebook and you can like the Diamond Conversations page, as well as head on over to Twitter. You can follow me at Wrestling Pal, or you can follow the show Twitter, which is in its infancy. Only a couple of followers and a little action on there so far, but it's Diamond Converse, C-O-N-V-E-R-S 1. Again, it's Diamond Converse, C-O-N-V-E-R-S 1, Diamond Converse 1 on Twitter. Yeah, it's ridiculous, but hey, got to get some sort of Twitter handle out there, and we'll work on it, but only a little bit of traction on there so far, but it's all growing. A lot of positive stuff going on behind the scenes here at Diamond Conversations as the show begins to grow, which I love. I am so happy. Only a couple episodes in, this thing is really starting to take off. So let's stay tuned here. Enjoy the interview with Chris Donnelly. Let's get into the DeLorean. Let's head back to 1985 and talk a little bit New York Met and New York Yankee baseball. Let's get back in here to Diamond Conversations, another great episode being broadcasted here on the Place to Be Podcast Network. Very happy to welcome in today, talking about the book Doc, Donnie, the Kid, and Billy Brawl, how the 1985 Mets and Yankees fought for New York's baseball soul. Very happy to welcome in author Chris Donnelly into Diamond Conversations. Chris, thanks for joining me.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
It's an absolutely fascinating topic, and I say that right out of the gate because as a Met fan, and I basically have established that on every episode of this podcast so far, I look at 1985 with a lot of parallels to this past season, but I look at 1985 as one of the biggest what-if years in the history of the franchise. So we'll talk about both the Mets and the Yankees, but what led to coming up with a book about that just absolutely fascinating year of New York baseball?
I was writing my first book, which was about the Yankees-Mariners 1995 division series. And as I was writing that, I was doing all this research from 1977 forward, when the Mariners came into existence, to draw parallels between the two teams. And as I'm going through the 80s, you sort of learn and you also forget just how bad and chaotic the New York Yankees were during that period. I would argue far more chaotic than anything that had happened during the Bronx Zoo years. And it just sort of dawned on me that while all that's happening to the Yankees, the Mets are doing the opposite. You know, they're actually sort of coming into their own. They're taking over New York City. And the original idea was to basically chart those two courses throughout the 1980s. And then I recognized that could be a 2,000 page book between everything that happened with both teams. So I thought, all right, let me get this down to something more specific. And I wanted to put it at where the teams meet going in opposite directions, the Yankees going down, the Mets going up. And it just so happened that they met in the middle of a decade in 1985. And they had essentially the same record, Mets 98-64, Yankees 97-64. They were both eliminated from the postseason on the second to last day of the year, the Saturday of the final weekend. And it was the first time since 62 when the Mets came in that the two teams were both competitive. And it just so happens that they were almost exactly the same team in terms of record and the end result that year.
Both teams obviously making huge moves in the winter heading into 1985. Obviously, with the Mets, it's Gary Carter. Yankees bring along Ricky Henderson, make a couple other signings that we can talk about in a little bit. But you look at the expectations that were there, maybe on paper, the Mets coming off a great year in 1984, and the Yankees, yeah, like you said, kind of, you know, it a little bit of a transition period with expectations what they were, you know, a 97-win team. 97 wins for the Yankees that year, pretty impressive. 98 wins for the Mets, maybe somewhat unexpected, but looking at the expectations, do you think both teams kind of lived up to what people were expecting?
I think they both exceeded expectations, but then once it became clear that both teams were playing well, ultimately I think people felt let down in the end. The Yankees, their offense, without question, was a force to be reckoned with in the American League, especially in the American League East, which was probably the toughest division in baseball. They had Don Mattingly, they had Dave Winfield, they had Don Baylor, they had Ricky Henderson. So you have two Hall of Famers and you have two people that some folks might say should be in the Hall of Fame. The question for the Yankees, as it would be for basically every year in the 80s, was their starting pitching. And really after Ron Guidry and Phil Negro, you had a bunch of question marks. And so I don't know if people were expecting too much from them at the start of 85. I thought they'd be a good team, or they thought they'd be a good team, but the defending champion Tigers, I think most people looked at them as probably taking the division and going back to the playoffs again. With the Mets, people were expecting big things. I don't think they knew exactly how big. The Mets sort of came out of nowhere in 1984. People knew that they were making moves and that they had a lot of talent in the minor league system. I think they were caught off guard by how quickly it all happened in 84, because the Mets were terrible in 1983. They were terrible throughout every year in the beginning of the 80s. And then in 84, under Davey Johnson, it all comes together. They win 90 games. They threaten the Cubs throughout most of the season for first place. And so I think there were high expectations. And then when they got Gary Carter, most people will say that he was really the final piece of the puzzle. And that's why the Carter trade is so big. It wasn't just that the Mets were becoming a better team. It was that they were trying to become the team, both in New York and in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously letting go in a piece in Hubie Brooks, you know, which is ultimately the spot that would end up kind of going to, you know, a mix of guys. You know, you had Ray Knight at third, you had Howard Johnson playing third base, but Hubie Brooks, you know, was a pretty impressive player in his own right. But the thing that I found very interesting early in the book is where you kind of piece together how that 85 Met team came to be. So you talk about the acquisition of Keith Hernandez. You talk about, you know, the acquisitions of Sid Fernandez, Ron Darling through trading. But then, you know, you kind of look at the Gary Carter one. Now, I did not know this, that Gary Carter was potentially going to Atlanta in a deal. And that was one thing that caught my eye right away because, you know, as Gary Carter, my favorite all-time player, I actually did not even know that.
Yeah, there were a couple teams that Carter, it was made very clear to Carter that he was no longer welcome with the Expos organization. The owner there did not think much of him, thought he didn't come up in the clutch. And it was really unfair criticism. Carter played hurt. He put up great numbers. He assimilated to the Montreal community, learned how to speak French. But he worn out his welcome there with the owner and with a lot of teammates who just thought that he was all too willing to get in front of the camera and smile all the time. And so he knew he was going, and he thought of a couple of teams that he'd want to go to. The Braves were a good option for him. He was building a home in Florida, so Atlanta wasn't that far away. And at the time, the Braves weren't in the same division as the Expos. They were actually in the National League West.
Right.
As were the Dodgers, and Carter was from California, so he thought that would be good, too. Ultimately, it didn't work out. He never really thought he was going to go to the Mets because they were an interdivision rival with the Expos, and he didn't think they would make that trade. But the Expos and Mets had sort of been talking about that for a while, and it really started as I can't trade you, Carter. The Expos GM Frank Ashton saying, I really can't trade Gary Carter. They'd run me out of town if I did that. But as time went on, the conversations grew more serious, and eventually the Mets were able to put together the pieces that were acceptable. And like you say, Hubie Brooks was Mets fans loved Hubie Brooks. He was an important player in 1984, and some of the other players that they traded were at the time, notable prospects, but I mean, once the Carter trade happened, that was it. That was really the unofficial beginning of New York becoming a Mets town.
Yeah, and doesn't really hurt when you hit the game winning home run on opening day. So that that's obviously you know, it lives in infamy in terms of Mets lore. It's played all the time, and you know, it's really one of the marquee moments, I'd say, of his entire career is that, you know, that little glimpse of him rounding first base with his hand in his air, in the air, and, you know, the fans yep. chanting, Gary, Gary, something that will last a lifetime. And that's where, you know, it pays off with the very first game.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, that was interesting. Carter was actually hit by a pitch in his first at bat with the Mets. Joaquin Andujar hit him, and he didn't know if he was actually going to be able to stay.
Right.
Sort of depressing at first, all this hype about him, and all of a sudden he might be injured, but he stayed in the game. He hadn't had a good day to that point, but then he hits a hanging knee on a breaking ball, sends it over the wall and left, and right there, and right off the bat, you are cementing your legacy in New York. People expect big things out of you when you deliver, and ultimately he delivered over the course of the next several games with another big hit, and that was it became a common thing, and Carter ate it up, and he loved the curtain calls, and all the things that really had started to anger people in Montreal, people in New York loved it. They loved that Carter jumped out. They loved that he came out for curtain calls. They loved that he did interviews. And eventually some of the things that had worn on people in Montreal would come back in New York towards the end of his stay there. But really in 85 and then obviously in 1986, Mets fans and teammates, they loved Gary Carter.
Yeah, absolutely. And you got a young team, so it's very impressionable, and it rubs off without a doubt. And you get that swagger that would ultimately be the 86 team, that those guys just were absolutely untouchable. They knew they were untouchable, and you had to come and beat them. Whereas that 85 team seems very gritty. It seems like it's a lot more of that day in, day out. And I find it to be very ironic that it was the Cardinals that they faced on opening day, because that would be their, you know, their obvious top competition throughout the entire year, culminating with that end of the season series they had.
Yeah, I think most people thought it was going to be the Cubs in 1985. They won the division in 84. They still had a strong team, but I believe as Wally Backman pointed out, the Cubs needed a lot of people to have career seasons again, and that just didn't happen. The Cardinals surprised a lot of people because they were, you know, the Whitey Herzog, the Whitey Ball kind of thing of bunting and stealing and hitting and running and really playing to Busch Stadium and the turf. The Cardinals, I believe, hit, I think it was 85 or 86 home runs in 1985, which was second lowest only to the Giants that year, but they managed to steal over 300 bases. Tommy Herr hit 8 home runs, still driving over 100 runs. So they were a perfect ball club for that stadium and for that time, and them and the Mets fought it out for the entire year, as you point out, going up until that the second-to-last series of the year in St. Louis. To a point you made about the 86 team, really, the 1986 Mets, all of that stuff that we know about that team started in 1985. Everything we know about the partying and the scum bunch and sort of this gritty, screw-you attitude, that all started in 85. Teams really, truly started to hate the Mets beginning in 1985. They didn't like their swagger. They didn't win anything, so they didn't understand how they could talk so much shit. People like the teams like the Dodgers and the Cardinals, that hatred that sort of manifested in 86, it all really started in 1985. And then, of course, in 86, after they won, it just made the teams hate them even more because now they had the swagger and the championship ring to back it all up.
Now, how about, let's talk about the generals there on the field. Let's talk about the managers. And obviously, you know, you've got a quite polarizing bunch and what they would end up being. So you have Davey Johnson in his second year, and then you also have Billy Martin. Kind of talk about how they played a factor in both teams' success, but also both teams' kind of maybe some of their weaknesses throughout the year.
Well, Davey Johnson, this was his second year as a manager. He had come up the Mets system as a manager, so he knew a lot of these players. They knew him. They were comfortable around him. And you hear the phrase often said about him a lot, Davey was a player's manager. And I think that's true, even if it is a bit of a cliche. But the point was, Davey respected his ball players and recognized that they were grown men. And so he was not going to be policing their off-the-field behaviors as long as they didn't do anything to embarrass the team. Davey was also one of the first people to really get into this concept of analytics and using computers and recognizing that outside of what you see before you in the game, you can analyze data and use it to your advantage. And to his credit, he was one of the first people to do that. David was a pretty sharp, smart guy, had a great business background. And he used that to get the most out of his players. And it's just one of those things where every now and then in baseball, you get the perfect person for the perfect team. And I think that was what happened with the Mets, that given the group of players that they had there, this hard partying, hard drinking ways, Davey Johnson was really the perfect guy for them. On the opposite side, on the Yankees side, this was Billy Martin's fourth time as manager of the Yankees. And at this point, the whole thing had gotten kind of tiresome. And Billy Martin's life was about patterns. And that pattern would be, he would come in into this team that was struggling or not meeting expectations, and he would immediately turn this around. And this happened in every single place that Billy Martin was a manager, not just in New York. He'd come in, he'd immediately turn things around, he'd get the accolades, people would love him. And then within a year, if not sooner than that, he would basically ruin it all through his antics, through his fighting, through the drinking. And that's what happened in 1985. And there's no question that Billy was a managerial genius that few people could match, just in how he saw the game and how he was thinking several moves ahead. But in 85, he comes in, the Yankees are 6-10. So they fired Yogi after 16 games, Yogi Berra, and that's why Yogi stayed away from Yankee Stadium for 14 years. And he immediately turns the team around, and they get better, and they're fighting for first place against the Blue Jays. And then in September, you have what I consider to be the strangest week and a half, 2 weeks in the entire history of the Yankees organization, where just one day after another, something bizarre happens. It's Steinbrenner coming in and calling Winfield Mr. May. It's Billy sending Mike Pagliarulo, who was a left-handed hitter, up to bat right-handed against a left-handed relief pitcher. Pagliarulo strikes out. It's Billy accidentally scratching his nose, which was the sign for a pitch out. And in a 2-0 count, Butch Weininger, the Yankees catcher, calls for a pitch out, which obviously didn't make any sense, but Billy had given the sign. And then it's Billy getting into a fight with a fan on a Friday night at the Kroskies Inn in Baltimore. And then the following night, getting into a fight with his pitcher, Ed Whitson, the famous fight again at the bar at the Kroskies Inn. And players will tell you that Billy was just unraveling. The pressure of George Steinbrenner, the pressure of trying to win first place in the division, had gotten to him yet again. And Billy is fired after the season. And remarkably enough, he comes back to manage the Yankees a fifth time in 1988. I mean, literally the exact same thing happens. He has the Yankees in first place. He gets beat up at a strip joint in Texas called Lace. He almost maybe would have gotten away with it, but as he's coming back from the strip club, there's a fire alarm at the hotel where everybody's staying, and George Steinbrenner is outside and sees Billy as he comes back with his ear almost detached from his head, and gets caught, and he gets fired. But even more remarkable than that is there probably would have been a Billy Six. Martin was telling people that he was going to come back and manage the Yankees a sixth time in 1990. George had been telling him that he was probably going to get rid of Bucky Dent, the Yankees manager. And we probably would have seen that if Billy hadn't died in a car crash on Christmas Day in 1989.
Yeah, I actually, you know, being young at the time, I actually do remember when Billy Martin passed away, and getting to, that was really my first exposure, learning more about his past, not really knowing that as a young one. But the Eddie Whitson fight is right. What I want to kind of dial back to, because that's who I alluded to earlier, being, you know, a free agent acquisition and not really, you know, maybe meeting the expectations that were on the table, and Eddie Whitson not lasting very long in New York, and absolutely not really hating the fans per se or the management, but it was the thing with Billy Martin that was just the death of him in New York. But kind of talk about that moment, especially a guy like Eddie Whitson who just came in, thought it was going to be a good move, and then just it did not last very long. A little bit into 86 is when they moved on.
Yeah, Whitson was a good pitcher. Had pitched in the National League for several years. He was on the Padres team that went to the World Series in 84. And as he did throughout the entire 1980s, George Steinbrenner threw a ton of money at him to come to New York. And as a lot of players did, at least in the early to mid-80s, Whitson took the money and went to New York. But Whitson, he was a good old boy. He was a country guy. He liked beer, and he was John Bercher kind of guy, conservative, and it just wasn't a good fit for New York, and especially not a good fit with Billy, because Billy's style was to yell at people and get tense and get mad and try and rile people up. That's not how Whitson responded to people. It just sort of made him shrink up more and become more tight, and hurt his performance even more. And it's people didn't really understand why Whitson wasn't pitching well in 85, and he wasn't pitching well. He would get hit and start after start after start. He wasn't injured. His stuff seemed to be the same, but it just wasn't working out. And that tension between Martin and Whitson sort of came to a head that September. Billy would tell reporters, well, Whitson told me he's hurting, his arm hurts, so I'm not going to start him. And then they would go to Whitson, and Whitson would say, I never told Billy my arm hurts. I'm fine, so I don't know what's going on. And then in that Baltimore series, Martin had told the press that whatchamacallit's arm is hurting, so that's why he's not starting. He actually called Whitson whatchamacallit. And this gets back to Whitson, and Whitson goes, my arm's fine. You know, go talk to Billy. He has all the answers. So Whitson's already riled up and kind of ready to go, and he thinks Billy's deliberately setting out to sabotage him. And they're in the bar that night. A Saturday night in Baltimore. The Yankees had just won, ending an 8-game losing streak. And Whitson is just going off about how Billy's trying to ruin him. There's a fan sitting at the table next to Whitson. It's a Yankee fan who's not sure what player this is that he hears ranting and raving. Yes, he thinks that Whitson is a rookie pitcher. Whitson sees him staring at him and says, what are you staring at? And the guy says, look, if I were making $90,000 a year, which was the league minimum at the time because he thinks he's a rookie, I wouldn't be behaving like this. Winston gets up from the table, grabs the guy by the throat, and essentially lifts him on the wall, against the wall. The guy has a mark on his neck 3 days, still 3 days after the fact, from what Winston did. As this is happening, some players go over to Billy, who's also in the bar, and say, look, this is happening, Eddie's in trouble. Billy goes over to help out Whitson. He didn't go to start a fight. He went over to help him. And he says, Eddie, you don't need this. You got to calm down. Whitson calls Billy a motherfucker, which, if you're Billy, is the magic words. And Billy punches him in the face. So now there's a fight going on. Whitson lets go of the fan, and he and Billy are fighting. The players try to break it up. They end up spilling into the hotel lobby. As they're in the lobby, one of Whitson's teammates is actually holding both of his arms behind his back. Billy comes charging at Whitson, and Whitson is actually trained in martial arts. So as Billy comes charging to him, he uses his strength to lift himself up, and he kicks Billy right in the groin.
Oof.
Billy falls to the ground, and as Bill Pennington has described it, almost like an action hero in a movie, he immediately rises back up, and he says, now you've done it. Now I have to do it. He charges at Whitson. The fight ends up spilling out into the parking lot in front of the hotel. Whitson, like a bull charging at a matador, tackles Billy into the ground. He breaks his arm. He breaks the rib. Players come out and separate them. They take Whitson back to the service elevator behind the hotel. Billy goes inside. He tries to find out what room Whitson is in because Billy Martin is incapable of just walking away from a fight. It's not over until he says it's over. They won't tell him what room Whitson is in, so he gets in an elevator and he heads up to the third floor. In the case of incredibly bad timing, Billy's elevator door opens and Whitson just happens to be walking right past it at that moment, and they fight a fourth time. So this fight took place in four different locations in and around the hotel that night. And by the time it happened on the third floor, reporters were actually able to call back to their home offices and dictate in real time the fight as it was occurring. But as I said, Billy ends up broken arm, broken rib. He looks like absolute hell. And although it was later found that Billy wasn't at fault necessarily for the fight, he also didn't walk away, and it's ultimately what Steinbrenner used to let Billy go a fourth time.
Unbelievable. Now, can you imagine if there was Twitter back in 1985?
I mean, these things are... They're simply not possible. The things that went on in 1985, you couldn't do them today because of Twitter and because everybody has a camera. I mean, that fight would have ended in the bar. There still may have been some shoving and some pushing, maybe even a punch thrown, but it would have ended right there in the bar because it couldn't possibly have been allowed to go on any further than that. But that said, in today's world, Billy Martin would have gotten the treatment that he needed. I don't think there's any question that Billy was an alcoholic and he would have gotten the treatment that he needed. And he would have had to have adjusted to today's world because he would have had to have deal with instant news and Twitter and the second guessing and all this and all that. But it's unfathomable to think of any of these events happening in today's. I mean, a couple of years ago, Jorge Posada left the stadium because he was mad that he was batting ninth in the starting lineup. And that was a huge scandalous thing. And that doesn't even come close to touching what used to happen in the 1980s for both the Yankees and the Mets.
No, not at all. Yeah. And we learned that in 86 as well with all this stuff that happened out in Houston.
Absolutely.
You know, we learned that on a grander stage. And there'd be books written about that if you want to read other books about the 86 season. But before we kind of head into the home stretch here, just want to talk about some of the other players that we haven't gotten a chance to mention. Obviously, you know, Don Mattingly coming off of a huge year, winning a batting title in 1984, 24 years old, seemingly like he's about to go on to be a Hall of Famer, no doubt. And on the other side of things, you got Daryl Strawberry kind of, starting to hit his stride, those moonshots being what they were. Another one kind of earmarked. This guy's headed to the Hall of Fame. Kind of talk about some of the other standout players of both teams in 85.
Yeah, I mean, Mattingly was definitely probably the guy for the Yankees. He won the MVP in 1985. He had won the batting title in 84. There were high expectations for him in 85, but I don't know if anybody really thought that was what was going to happen, that he'd win the MVP. And I'll just throw some numbers out at you. And I mean, this is really the reason why Mattingly won it. But after August 1st, Mattingly played 61 games. He hit 23 home runs, had 66 RBIs, 5 multi-homer games, 6 games with 3 or more RBIs, and he batted 350 during that time. And,
wow.
And just to, if you stretch those numbers out over a full season, that's 56 home runs, 161 RBIs, a 350 batting average, 222 hits. So, I mean, he just put up these astronomical numbers. He drove in 145 runs, which hadn't been done in a couple of decades, and wouldn't be done again for a little while until we saw sort of the steroid era numbers that were put up in the 90s. And it really established him as one of, if not the premier players in the game of baseball. Then you had Strawberry, who at this point, again, was turning into maybe the premier power hitter in the National League. He would just hit these incredible home runs. And it wasn't just that the distances that he hit him. I mean, Strawberry was just sort of beautiful to watch, just that big leg kick and that looping swing. And he would hit these monstrous home runs. The home run in St. Louis during that second-to-last series that he hit off of the clock, which actually stayed behind the bleachers in right field. They don't really know how far it went. They say 430 or 440. A lot of people swear it went a lot farther than that. But he would just hit these majestic drives. But at the same time, you were already starting to see some of the issues that would emerge later on with Strawberry in terms of the moodiness and maybe not being as injured as he said he was and not having his head in the game. That really started to become a problem in 85 and would sort of explode in the later years with the Mets. But at that time, he was just still a great player to watch. And one more person I just want to note is Blake Gooden, who won the Cy Young Award in 1985 in the National League. He had one of the best single-season, regular seasons of any pitcher in history. And I don't mean in the 80s. I don't mean in the expansion era. I mean of any pitcher in Major League history. We know the final numbers, 24-4, 1.63 ERA. I just want to, again, I don't want to bog people down with stats, but I just want to give a couple of numbers to demonstrate just how dominating Gooden was that year. After May 30th, Gooden made 25 starts. He was 18-1 in those 25 starts with a 1.39 ERA. In 10 of those 25 starts, 40%, he didn't give up a single run. And in 15 of those 25, he pitched at least 9 innings. And I know that some of these numbers are not necessarily in a day of analytics what we measure players by anymore, but still, these numbers are incredible. And then down the stretch in September, from September 1st on, so at a time when his arm really should be tiring and maybe he's not as dominating, but when the Mets really need him to step it up, he makes 6 starts. He goes 4-0 with a .040 ERA. In 53 innings, he gives up 53 hits. In those 2 starts where he didn't get a decision, he gave up 0 runs.
Wow.
So Gooden was just absolutely dominating that year, like nothing many people had seen at that time, and maybe we haven't seen since. And I don't dwell on the book really about sort of this what could have been or what should have been. That wasn't really my aim here. My aim was to sort of be happy for the moment in that it happened and not sort of lament that Gooden maybe never reached his full potential, because what he did in 1985 is just astounding.
Not many other years where we could point out and say this Met team versus this Yankee team would be that close to playing each other in a World Series. Obviously, outside of 2000 in the Subway Series, you think about 99, that there was a good chance it was going to happen there. But, you know, you shudder to think about that 85 team. If you had to fantasy book this, if you were going to go back and say we were going to just erase everything else, this is a 1985 Mets versus 1985 Yankees World Series, who do you go with and give me an MVP?
I knew this question was coming because I've gotten it before, and I have to be honest, and this is not a cop-out. I genuinely don't know the answer to that question because I think the teams were so evenly matched. The Yankees dominating offense versus the Mets dominating pitching. I mean, how do you know who wins in a battle between Dwight Gooden that year, the National League MVP, and Don Mattingly? The National League Cy Young and Don Mattingly, the American League MVP. Do you know what happens with Phil Nicklin's knuckleball, Darryl Strawberry? I mean, or Ron Guidry and Gary Carter? It's really, truly a missed opportunity in 85, although I'm sure the rest of the country doesn't agree.
Right.
But New York would, that we didn't have a Subway Series. It could have gone down as one of the greatest in the history of baseball. The 2000 Subway Series was fun. I don't necessarily think the teams were that evenly matched. I think 99 would have presented probably a better series had that actually happened.
Yes.
But in 1985, you had two teams that were really, you can't get much closer than these two were. The only difference really was in some of the personalities. I think it's a lost opportunity. They say good pitching always beats good hitting, and if that's the case, then you probably have to take the Mets. But who knows what would have happened.
That's why I got to ask, because you never know. And instead, Missouri gets the the all Missouri World Series instead.
Of course.
So I'm sorry, did I lose you?
I'm still here.
Oh, okay. I thought you dropped off. Yeah. So yeah, Missouri gets the all Missouri World Series. So good for them. We had the Subway Series. Although if I was going to make a prediction, how about I say 85 Mets in four. Gary Carter MVP, hits about 15 home runs. That's not out of the ordinary, right? I think that'd be perfectly fine. So there you go. But exactly. Yeah, this has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate you coming on and talking about the book, because really, it's a fascinating topic, a fascinating year, not only in just New York, but in all of baseball. Just is a very cool transitional year through the middle of the 1980s. And this has been an absolute blast to talk about this. Really, if I could say it's one of my favorite topics in baseball, it really is, because it's the what if of the century. So before we wrap it up, I want to hand it over to you. Please share with the listeners of Diamond Conversations where they can find anything and everything going on in your world, any kind of place they can pick up the book, get their hands on it, because if you're a fan of New York baseball, this is the absolute book for you.
Sure. You can follow me on Twitter. It's at C Donnelly, D-O-N-N-E-L-L-Y 81. And the book is available on Amazon. You can also get it at Barnes & Noble off University of Nebraska Press as well.
Yeah, again, please pick it up. It's an absolute fascinating look at the year that was 1985, and I really appreciate you coming on. And maybe we can reconvene and talk about that 95 Mariners-Yankee series again. You know, even as a Met fan, watched it on the edge of my seat because the Yankees couldn't go on in 95. Come on, this wasn't... we were rooting for the Yankees
at
that point.
I'm sure you loved the results. Yeah, I'm sure you were really happy with the results. So I'd love to talk about that, too.
I was more impressed at how fast Griffey is running around on those bases. So I really appreciate you coming up.
Subject.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So obviously we know where you fall in the Met-Yankee fan debate. So very, very nice. Yep. But absolutely just had a blast being able to talk about this with you today. And thank you so much for spending the time to come on.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The PlayStation Wrestling feed. We dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content, offering tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceMination.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceMination.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceMination.com, the only place to be in your pop culture.